This is the third session in the science and ethics strand at the Battle of Ideas, and it's called the International Abortion Wars. Welcome to the session. My name is Ellie Lee. I work as a professor at the University of Kent, but I also am the director there of a research centre called the Centre for Parenting Culture Studies. And we have had the privilege for some years now of being able to programme sessions at this event. So I wanted, first of all, just to thank, even though she's not in the room, thank Claire Fox and Jeff Kidder for again giving us the opportunity to raise some issues which we wanted to raise. People might have been here for the first session that we programmed, which was at the start of the day in this room on epigenetics. So this is our second session. And we asked this year specifically to program a discussion on the topic of abortion. The main reason for doing that, which I would imagine most people in this room are probably aware of, is that this conference falls almost exactly to the day on the 50th anniversary of the passage of the 1967 Abortion Act. Did you all know that? So that was on Friday, that particular anniversary. So it seems silly, really, not to do something about it, given that anniversary. But obviously, it's not necessarily the case that you just want to mark anniversaries because there's anniversaries. Rather, it's because there's, I think, an awful lot to discuss. Because in the 50 years since the 1967 Act has passed, an awful lot has happened in every respect. Most obviously, since then, almost 9 million pregnancies have been terminated in this country, and obviously many, many millions more worldwide. But it means that certainly in Britain, our society has a great deal of experience of legal abortion. Women have a great deal of experience of legal abortion. Medical services have a great deal of experience of providing them. And our society, since that time, has been almost continuously debating the issue, both within Parliament and outside of it. A colleague of mine has just documented the number of bills that there have been in Parliament since 1967, and it's 49. It will soon be 50. So it's been a continual part of our social debate, but a lot of things have changed too. A great deal has changed in terms of medical technology, not just in relation to abortion, but the whole field of reproductive medicine. And of course, our social mores around family, what we think about children, what we think it means to be a parent, all of those things have changed too. So it seemed to be a very good opportunity to reflect on an awful lot. In collecting a panel for this discussion, I also, though, wanted to make sure that we could set our gaze beyond the shores of our country, because it's not just Britain where this issue remains debated and very important. That's also the case, obviously, all over the world. So what I've aimed to do is to collect a panel together with a great deal of experience between them, of providing abortion, discussing abortion through their lives, really, their adult lives. Their careers have been dedicated toward this issue. So I'm just going to introduce them. This is Anne Faraday, who I'm sure is familiar to quite a lot of people in this audience because she's spoken regularly at this event, but is also on the news and in the newspapers all the time, talking about her views. Anne has been the Chief Executive Officer of the British Pregnancy Advisory Service since 2003. Now, BPAS in this country is the main provider of late abortion services, but overall provides almost 70% now of termination of pregnancy procedures in this country. So BPAS is a very important organisation in regard to the provision of abortion in Britain. Anne also has an international reach herself. She's a board member of the American research charity Ibis Reproductive Health, and spends a lot of time in the States and also other countries discussing the issues and debating them. And she's also the author of a book published last year called The Moral Case for Abortion. So that's Anne. This is Kinga Jelenska. Kinga hails from Poland. where she studied cultural anthropology. But what she is primarily is an activist both involved in providing abortion, but in a way which most certainly predates anything that the 1967 Act ever envisaged, because Kinga's main area of activity involves the provision of early medical abortion, abortion pills, as they're commonly known. And she does so in a way which is outside of conventional medical services. Kinga is the executive director of an organisation called Women Help Women, which is an online non-profit service which provides contraception, abortion pills, counselling, and also does research, but outside of the boundaries of either conventional medical services and indeed outside of the boundaries of national laws. I think that would be fair to say. So Kinga is a very interesting person with a great deal of experience of doing something very different to what anybody was doing in the 1960s and the 1970s in a global sense. John O'Brien at the end there. John is the president of an American organization called Catholics for Choice. Catholics for Choice isn't a provider of services. It's an advocacy organization which acts globally. John has worked on 5 of the 7 continents in the world. I don't know which 2 you have been absent from and if you plan to go there. But there are only 2 he has not worked in, together with organizations in those continents who advocate for choice in abortion. John is a lifelong Catholic. He is a member of the Catholic faith, and the organisation he works for is an organisation which sees itself as based in the Catholic faith and advocates for abortion from that perspective. And at the end here, Alva Smith. Alva is from the Republic of Ireland. She is an academic in part. She was the founding head of women's studies at University College Dublin, but left academia in 2006 to become a full-time activist, really, working with women's organisations and other organisations on a range of issues, but centrally on abortion. Very significantly, Alva is the chair of an organisation called the Coalition to Repeal the 8th Amendment. Have people in this room, do you know what the 8th Amendment is in Ireland? Well, the 8th Amendment in Ireland is an amendment to the Irish Constitution. The Constitution was amended in 1983 following a referendum in Ireland, and what that amendment does is introduce into the Irish Constitution the recognition of right to life of the unborn child. And since 1983, as a result, this has been a very contentious issue. Next year, there is going to be another referendum, and hence the Repeal the 8th Coalition and its activities. So that's our panel. Now, one thing you may have noticed, well, there's 2 things to notice about our panel altogether then. One is that overall, they have a great deal of experience over a very long time of pertinent issues. But they are all people who are for women having access to abortion. Now, I want to say at the outset, I did that on purpose. So if somebody says this is a very unbalanced panel, I'm just preempting you saying that. That doesn't mean that you need to agree with them about anything at all. You can completely disagree with them about absolutely everything and anything. So if you want to take them to task and demand of them to justify what their fundamental beliefs are on this issue, then please go ahead, and we would very much welcome that discussion. What I'm going to do, instead of have the panel just give introductory comments, I'm going to ask them some questions for a little while and discuss that for about probably 15 minutes or so. And then it's going to be over to you. And I thought it might be nice to do that just to have a slightly different format for the discussions. And really what I want to do is to have our panel talk as much as possible about what they think about the present situation on the basis of everything that they know and have done. And particularly tell us what they think about what's different now in the situation when it comes to abortion from their point of view. Because as I say, I think a great deal has changed, certainly since abortion was first made legal in this country. And what I wanted to start off with was to ask you, and I'm going to begin with John. What is it, John, that you think, from your point of view, certainly in America, but also on the other continents in which you've worked, that you think are the main issues that you think you're battling with or trying to address? I should say that the background to this is that for when I first started following these issues a long time ago, the basic slogan of people who supported access to abortion was not the church, not the state, women must decide their fate. So there's a very clear statement that the problems were the church and the state. What I want to know is if that's how it looks now, because the church and the state have both changed a great deal in recent decades. And of course, since you're from America, I feel obliged to ask you what you think about Donald Trump.
I was afraid of that. From day one, the Trump administration saw women's health and rights as political payback to the more conservative parts of the Republican Party. Trump doesn't care about abortion, but those in his administration do. So Mike Pence is vice president, Kellyanne Conway, Catholic spokesperson, very anti-abortion. Bannon, who was recently in the administration, he's also an anti-choice Catholic. So Trump saw this as being a way that he can pay back these interests within the party. It's been terrible. They reintroduced and even expanded a thing called the global gag rule. What's interesting about the global gag rule, you couldn't have it in the United States of America because we have free speech, but you can have it as part of an administration in other countries, saying that basically if you talk about abortion, if you provide abortions, you cannot receive government, US government aid. The problem with that is that a lot of people in different parts of the world, Africa, Latin America, Asia, rely on government aid. So what you do is you effectively silence some of the most effective advocacy organizations working within their own countries when they're working on issues around legalizing abortion. The second thing the Trump administration did was the defunding of family planning. So Planned Parenthood Federation of America, under huge threat of defunding, the Affordable Care Act, which allowed no-cost birth control for people, is being stripped of its contraceptive provision. So what you have is you have political payback by an administration that doesn't care about these issues. And I think that that doesn't just have a negative effect in the United States of America. I think because of the role that the United States plays, the fact that we have an administration that is hostile to women's health, women's rights, is hostile to the idea of freedom of conscience, women's bodily autonomy, I think that that sets a very bad leadership standard. So that's the downside. The upside, I want to say, is in Chile. An anti-abortion law was introduced 28 years ago by the when the Pinochet dictatorship was in its dying days. And that anti-abortion law has been on the books in Chile for many, many years. And I was really proud this year, led by the Prime Minister Bachelet, and the Parliament, politicians, actually stood up and voted to decriminalize abortion in certain circumstances. It's still narrow, but the fact that a Latin American parliament, against the condemnation of the church hierarchy, would get up and stand with women, I think there's something for me that's very inspiring when I see politicians willing to stand up for women in that way, in spite of the threats that they received. So in one way, the glass is half empty. In the United States of America, we've got a huge job to do. But elsewhere in the world, I see people positively stepping towards the idea that choice is an important thing to allow women.
Okay. Can I just ask you, John, on Trump? It's obviously very febrile, and he's done these things that you describe. But how deep do you think the roots go in terms of this deal you say he's made? I mean, how much traction do the people that he thinks he's really trying to buy off or appeal to have?
I think, well, it's the nature of politics, right? That you form a coalition of different interests and then you pay back those interests. I don't think the Democrats are much different when they get into power. I think that that is part of the problem for me. The Democratic Party recently, Bernie Sanders, recently said that I've no problem people being in the party who are anti-abortion. Considering it's one of the basic principles of the Democratic Party, it's a little bit worrying to hear Saunders say such a thing. Then Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, she said, the abortion issue is somewhat over. So what we're seeing with the Democrats is they're stepping away from abortion with the idea that, that's what cost them the election, being too committed to the idea of choice. That's not what lost them the election. They ran a dreadful campaign with a candidate who was really unpopular, and they said some really stupid things. That's what why they lost the election. But it worries me when I see, just as I praise the political leadership in Chile, who decides to, whether you would have an abortion or not is not the question. It's the idea that you trust women to be able to make that decision. So we see in Chile, politicians trusting women. In the United States, you see a very cynical attitude, I think, towards the rights of women. Like, could you imagine the Democratic Party saying that, you know something, this civil rights thing, this rights for black people in the United States, that could cost us a couple of votes. Maybe we should get rid of that. I don't think they'll do that. They won't get rid of civil rights, but it seems that women's rights all too often are tradable, negotiable, and ultimately people feel no difficulty in selling out on them.
Kinga, it's the same question for you. You can tell us about Poland if you want to, or about anywhere else in the world where you're working.
Yeah, I think nowadays a question that is more relevant than ever for me is who controls the abortion, right? Because in a classic paradigm for fighting for abortion rights, we would be fighting for legal abortion, right? Legal abortion would mean safe abortion. Legal abortion would mean abortion that's provided by health professionals in a safe conditions, controlled. However, what happened in the meantime is the introduction also of a new technology called abortion with pills. And the technology itself is very confrontational to those ideas of this classical paradigm of advocacy. And why is that? Because essentially, you can have an illegal abortion with pills that would be very safe as long as you have information and access to pills. And essentially, you can have a safe abortion that you can control yourself at your own terms in the privacy of your own home. So that is the thing that in an abortion landscape changed and has deep consequences for how laws are constructed, how advocacy arguments are constructed, and also for the discourse. So what I see now as most relevant is that this issue of control is even more striking than ever before, in a sense that the battle here is about, the discourse is really centered on autonomy, right? And the battle here is with a question, who can control the abortion? And the classical take would be that it is, the control of abortion is put in the hands of third parties, be it usually doctors, right? And that's just simply not the case anymore because women can control abortion. Having said that, it does not mean that abortion advocacy should forget about the whole idea of state and accountability of state for providing healthcare. And that's still today extremely relevant, and I don't think that it really changed from about 30 years ago, because we still see that state, through its legislation, indeed puts this control over abortion in the hands of third parties, such as doctors. That's exactly the case in Britain, right? That two doctors must sign for to allow a woman to have an abortion, or through its laws, the completely criminalizes abortion services, and that's still the case in most of the global South. As respect to Poland, I think we see exactly the same kind of discourse that we see in the US, that is very much attacking women's rights in general. It is also very much intertwined with the idea of what a true Pole is or should be. So we see also the sort of a marriage with nationalist ideas, so that's also very relevant. I think what is also new in the discourse, and specifically anti-choice discourse, is this demonization of doctors and abortion providers and claims that abortion is essentially bad for women. So it's not so much anymore about the fetus per se and sort of a moral status of the fetus as compared to the woman, but all kinds of circumstantial argument around.
Do you think with Alva, because of the significance of abortion pills as well, this is something I also wanted to ask you. So this phenomenon King is talking about with women using abortion pills outside of the law, which put matters into their own hands, that's really sparked things a great deal in Ireland, right?
Yes, I mean, I do think that's been really, really important. I do want to say, first of all, Ellie, if it's okay, that the 1967 Act has been incredibly important for women in Ireland. Without it, you know, women in Ireland would have been in the most ghastly, more women would have been in the most ghastly, desperate straits. So that every time there is another bill going through UK Parliament, we take deep breaths and get panic attacks and get desperately worried, because every year, at least 3,500 women come to the UK for an abortion. They give addresses in Ireland. There will be more, but those are the ones who do that. And that's down from about 6,500 if we look back to, say, the early 1980s. And what this means is that, you know, if you look at 6,500 down to 3,500, that there have been a lot of really very important changes. It's not that there is actually necessarily less abortion, but that certainly one of the key factors is that women increasingly over the past three, perhaps 4 years, Anne, you would know better than I, but have been accessing the abortion pill. It's illegal. In Ireland, abortion is completely illegal except to save a woman's life. And even then, that can be debated and disputed. It's not only illegal, it is punishable by imprisonment, by a term of imprisonment of up to 14 years, which is extremely stiff. And it's not only the woman who accesses abortion who can be criminalised, but anyone who would help her. So, for example, if I'm involved in getting abortion pills illegally from a service abroad, and I'm giving them to another woman, I too could be in jail for up to 14 years. The fact that there have been no prosecutions doesn't lessen the fear, and it doesn't do anything to reduce the stigma. It just simply shows you how unworkable our situation is. So just to say that some of the things I think that have changed apart from the abortion pill, we also have to look at really practical things. Ryanair actually came in. I'm not in favour of Ryanair, actually. What am I saying? I hate Ryanair. I was standing on the steps for 40 minutes yesterday. But the point is, cheap flights to Britain became more available. You could go to Liverpool really easily. You go to Manchester, you go to Birmingham, you go to Bristol, you come to London. That was absolutely huge. And every time I step on a Ryanair flight, particularly in the morning, early in the morning, I look around me and I think 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, up to 10 or 11 of these women are going over to Britain for an abortion. Other things, other factors that certainly came in are somewhat better sex education, but also being able to access contraception. When I was a young woman, you couldn't. In 1983, it was very difficult still to access contraception. But you couldn't buy condoms in a vending machine until 1992. So, you know, we're talking about living memory and recent past here. So there are a lot of factors which have changed in Ireland over this period of time. But perhaps the one which is now, I suppose, really, which is incredibly significant, but which is also changing the way we're doing our politics and the way we talk about abortion, is the relative accessibility of the abortion pill. How safe it is, how comparatively cheap it is, how comparatively easy it is for there to be medical supervision provided, all of these factors, and how fundamentally for women in Ireland it reduces that sense that they have of stigma in relation to abortion, because that is the huge big problem for women, that it is so highly stigmatized. You know, things I haven't talked about, because you know I don't want to go on too long, but there have been interesting things happening about the nature of really institutional religion, specifically Catholicism, which is also a very important factor in this whole process of change. I think I went off piste a bit on that and did that political thing of saying what I wanted to say rather than what
you wanted to say. No, that's absolutely fine.
Probably. Sorry about that.
I'm going to ask Anne what she thinks, but I'm also just going to throw in another question, which you can start us off on as well. So the other side of this slogan, not the church, not the state, was women must decide their fate. And this is the other thing I want you to all comment on, and I'm going to, so you can do both bits together, Anne. One of the things that I think is interesting at the moment from the point of view of people who argue in favour of access to abortion is that there seem to be question marks being raised about both the women aspect of this and the deciding your fate aspect of this. So I have been in lots and lots of discussions now where the idea of choice and women choosing abortion has been presented by people who support abortion as a neoliberal problem, and that we've got to stop talking about choice because choice isn't really the right word, because that's all about consumerism. So I wanted to know what you think about that. Do you think we should ditch choice? Do we need another concept, or is it a good one? And you don't have to comment on this. I know John doesn't particularly want to. But there are also discussions going on about the idea that this isn't even about women anymore. So it's about people, and that we now have to say that people get pregnant and people need abortions, not women, which is one outcome of the way issues around trans questions and gender fluidity have come to present themselves. I'm sure there's people in the audience who are interested in some of these things. You may or may not want to comment on them, but I think that side of things is interesting too. So, Anne, I'm going to throw both things at you to start with, and then the others of you can comment on the erstwhile pro-choice side of things.
I would quite like to start on the kind of what's changed thing, and then I might come back on some of the others a bit later, because I think that in Britain it's quite amazing that we're now in a situation where there is seriously discussion about the potential for the decriminalisation of abortion, where we've got the Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynaecologists, we've got the British Medical Association, the Royal College of Midwives have all come out in favour of decriminalisation of abortion. We had a bill into Parliament, a private member's bill that had a majority in favour of decriminalisation, and then there was the general election and that all had to kind of go back to base. And I think in some ways it's taken quite a lot of people by surprise, because people think, well, what the heck's all the fuss about? Because actually, probably in Britain now, anyone who is resident, any woman who's resident in the UK not in Northern Ireland, but in Britain, can get an abortion on the National Health Service, and it doesn't really seem to be very much of an issue. And I think that one of the things that has changed monumentally in the 20, 25 years that I've been an activist is how the interpretation of the Abortion Act has changed as society has changed, and abortion has become both accepted and acceptable. And I think it's become accepted because one of the things that is now just regarded as being a general state of being in Britain is that women should be able to plan their pregnancies. And the idea that if contraception fails or we fail to use it properly, that a woman should be compelled to put up with the consequences in terms of having a child that she doesn't want at that particular time is just seen as being totally unacceptable. So we now live in a society where one in three women will have an abortion at some stage in her life, and that it is, abortion is a backup to other methods of birth control. And we kind of forget that even when I started running BPAS 14 years ago, even though the law was exactly the same and the regulations were actually exactly the same, the NHS didn't pay for all of the abortions in the way that it does now. A third of women had to pay for their own abortion because it was seen as being something that just wasn't really part of healthcare. And I think now it's really embedded in. And I think there's a little bit of a sense that the workarounds that we've been doing to allow women effectively abortion on request shouldn't be a dance that needs to be gone through anymore. And that some of the restrictions that the law has, particularly on early medical abortion, are getting in the way. So the law at the moment says that if you want to have this pill, as Kinga says, you know, in other places, people can pretty much buy online. You don't need to be in a clinic for it. But in Britain, to have that abortion legally, you have to take both tablets in a clinic. Nurses can't carry out abortions, it's only doctors. So I think that the law, that's really changed, and we're now privileged to be living in a society where abortion is fully funded and supported by society, and the anti-choice movement are a real minority. And so I would say that there is a sense now that, you know, abortion should not be criminalised, that women should be able to make their decision. Whether it's people that we use as a word or whether it's women, I'd be really interested. I'd like to come back on that later, but I'd like other people to say what they think.
Well, I'll tell you what we'll do then is come out, hold your thoughts then, panel, on the choice word and the people word. John, I did also want to, I know I'm picking on you a lot, but just throw in, because there's obviously one very distinctive thing about John compared to the rest of us. And
he's
John is...
He's a Catholic.
Well, there's that, but there's the other very obvious thing about John, and he is unusual in being a male advocate of reproductive choice. And one thing I was interested to know is whether you ever get accused of white male privilege, and whether you're ever told that your views don't count on that basis. Okay, let's go out then, and we can keep these other questions in as part of the discussion. So there's a little cluster of hands there. Let's start there. Two people, and then this one here. Yes?
I've got a question for John. As a religious person, how do you sort of mentally and emotionally reconcile the fact that I shouldn't make this assumption, but I'm assuming that you believe, as Catholicism believes, that, you know, all people are made in God's image. How do you reconcile that with sort of bodily autonomy and pro-choice abortion?
Okay, good question. Yeah, and in front there.
Well, basically, when John, he said that it's about trusting women to make their own choices, but why should you have to trust a woman when it's her choice? It's not... Okay, that kind of went off. Like, why should others have to trust a woman when it's what's right for her own body? Because she's supposed to know more than other people are supposed to know what's good for her rather than anything else. And it's like, not everyone does want kids. Not everyone really wants to. And sometimes they may be safe, and sometimes they may do everything they can to not get pregnant, and still they do. Should it, like... but the fact, because of that, it's like, it should be right that they should have an abortion because they did everything they could to not get pregnant, and yet they still did.
You saying in the first bit that how do we know that women can be trusted?
No, it's like, why should you have to trust a woman to know what's good for her own body? Why should you, shouldn't you just know that she knows?
So that should just be assumed?
It should just be assumed that she does know what's right for her rather than you having to trust her Okay. Trust shouldn't actually come into the fact that she knows what's right for her own body.
Okay. Over here, and then do you want to give that mic there? Yes.
I identify myself as a Muslim, my religion doesn't agree with abortion, but that doesn't mean that I believe that I should impose the rules of my religion on other people. So I am pro-choice. I wouldn't choose to have an abortion, but other people can make that choice. That's none of my business. My question is about how we kind of control that choice. I don't want to come to the choice because we haven't spoken about it yet, but I do want to comment on that later on.
No, you can do that now. That's fine.
Okay. One thing that I wanted to talk about is I spent 3 months in India, and the state Rajasthan, they have they allow abortion. It's legal, but what's happening is that after having discussions with people, people are making choices to have abortions because they have females in their stomach, and I don't agree with that. I don't think that you should have abortion because of the gender. So how do we control that? How do we control it? Is it through education? I don't agree. I don't think that we should get rid of abortion, but is it through education? I don't know why isn't that happening. I think that something should happen about that. But another thing is when you spoke about neoliberalism and choice in abortion, when we think of the word choice, what doesn't sit well with me is that do women have full choice? Can they make that decision? And it's like what influences that decision? Is it I have to have an abortion because I can't afford to have this child? And that's something that I think is quite sad, because really and truly they want that child and they want to have that child, but they can't because they can't feed that child or they can't clothe that child. And I think that something should happen about that. That women shouldn't make that choice and say that I can't have this child because I can't afford clothes for it. I can't afford food for it. And I don't know the answer to that, and I just want to know what you guys think of that.
Okay, take one more here, then I'm going to bring the panel in for brief comments, and then I can see there's four hands down here, so I'll come to you next.
I guess I'm going to do the obligatory hijacking with male privilege and recenter men in this discussion. So on the point of it's about women deciding their fate, does the panel think, and this is something I'm not sure about, that men should have any say? So not should they be able to control a woman's body, but, for example, should they be able to opt out of parenthood in the same way that the woman can via abortion? Could the man perhaps sign a contract to say, essentially, a de facto abortion on their part?
Okay. Who wants to start? Alva, do you want to? Anything, you can pick up on anything that you want to.
Yeah, let me just pick up on the last one and work back a little bit. I don't work in health service provision, but it's certainly our experience campaigning for very many years, since 1983, on this issue, that women do very often and quite very typically talk with their partners, with their male partners, about the abortion or about the choice, about what is to be done, what can be done, and so on. But that's not always possible for women. I don't think that it should be an obligation either, because it is the woman, after all, who becomes pregnant, who carries the baby, who will bear the responsibility, and so on and so forth. So on a very, very, very practical level, I think that it is happening that women actually do talk about what's possible, the possibilities and their preferences and their desires. They do talk about it with their partners, perhaps with their wider family, with their friends, and so on. But that fundamentally, it is a woman's decision. It is a woman's choice. It is her body. And I was thinking, as I was, coming along this morning to the battle of ideas, I was thinking, in Ireland, what we have is a battle of bodies. It's over bodies and whose body. And we also say, as well as, women must decide not their fate, but our fate, women must decide our fate. We also say, my body, my choice. Our bodies, our choice. And I think that's a very, very fundamental thing. So it's almost more than a philosophical point. It is something that you live viscerally in your own body. So that by all means, women can be supported to discuss with their partners if that's what they want to do. And if it's not what they want to do, I think men should have enough respect and understanding to step smartly back right? So perhaps I'll just pass on, having dealt with men.
John, on Catholicism and gender.
First of all, as regards the Catholic question, in my religion, conscience is the final arbiter in moral decision-making. It's not that you should follow your conscience, or maybe it's a nice thing. You have to follow your conscience. Very often for Catholics around the world, when they're faced with a decision, whether it's using contraception or having an abortion, they do go against what the bishops might say. That doesn't mean that they're not Catholic. Doesn't mean they're not good Catholics. It's that you can dissent, and where there is doubt, there is freedom. So that's what Catholics do. 99% of Catholic women in the United States use the method of birth control the bishops disagree with. 99%. Catholic women have abortions at the same rate as those of no religion or other religions. So Catholics are not that much different. And look, Portugal, Spain, Italy, Chile. Catholics are much the same as everybody else. I believe that when a woman has an abortion, she ends life in the uterus. That shouldn't be avoided. That's a fact. The fact that personhood, the 1974 Declaration on Procured Abortion from the Vatican said that they did not know when personhood begins. So again, where there's doubt, there's freedom. And interestingly enough, many Muslim teachers of the Quran would say that at least in early pregnancy, within your faith, within the Muslim faith, it is possible to have an abortion. So I think religion and freedom can be complicated, but I do believe that Catholics and people of faith very often make the same decisions as those of no faith. As regards trusting women, I think the reason why I assert that we should trust women is that it is very often contested. The idea that, like, does a woman have a choice, or should the state or a religion, a particular religion, be making decisions for that individual? I would say that choice is very important. I have no intention of stop using the idea of choice. And for those who say it's consumerist, they are, how do I say this, wrong. And I think it's stupid, because I think that far from being a consumerist idea of choice, I see choice being really led from two very powerful principles that have a great history and a great philosophy. That's the idea of conscience and the idea of autonomy. I think both ideas are absolutely essential for us today and will be tomorrow. The idea of they have abortions, I won't be using that, because I don't believe that women need to be made invisible about the question of abortion, number one. And number two, I don't think it does anything for my trans brothers and sisters to be saying they. So as far as I'm concerned, women have abortions and women have choice. I think that as regards men, should men be involved in the decision to have an abortion? I think a lot of my women friends would tell me, yes, men should be involved. And in an ideal world, if you find yourself pregnant and you have a partner, the idea that you wouldn't sit down with your partner and get solidarity and get help, get support, I think that many people would find that an ideal circumstance. Sometimes women don't find themselves in ideal circumstances, and no, because where the because of autonomy, because the pregnancy resides within the woman, I believe that it is her choice. As regards men working on this issue, I don't think that I believe in the old idea of solidarity. And I think the idea that we work with one another, for one another, you don't have to experience something yourself to care about another person. And I think when I see women dying, especially in the developing world, because they don't have access to contraception and they don't have access to abortion, I'd find it very difficult as a man not to speak out about that.
Okay.
I'd really agree with that. I wanted to say something about the choice thing and something about the sex selection thing. On the choice thing, I think, you know, it is one of those things that you look at the decisions that we make in life, and I'd say the decisions that we make, particularly about these things that are kind of personal and private, are kind of driven by two things. They're driven by the circumstances that we find ourselves in. That's really true. But they're also driven by the values and the personal beliefs and so on that we have, to the point where you can't predict. Two people who are in exactly the same circumstances will not necessarily make the same decisions about what they want to do. So when we say, for example, that a woman is driven by poverty to have her abortion, women may very well say, and you know, I would absolutely believe them, well, you know, if I wasn't so if I was in different financial circumstances, I would have this child. And that's often what people will say when they come to clinics. But at the same time, people who are in the same financial circumstances will make the decision that they will have that child. A woman, for example, who gets a diagnosis of Down syndrome, you know, one woman will feel, I have no alternative but to have an abortion. Another woman will decide, even though I have this, I will have a child with Down syndrome, I will have this child. And the point is that I don't think that we should see that the circumstances that we live in drive us as though we don't have any ability to kind of override that by the values that we have. And that's why it's not good enough when people sort of say, oh, well, if we gave women more financial support, if we had better childcare, if we had better da-da-da-da-da, women would make different decisions. Some women might make different decisions, but some women wouldn't because they just don't want to make a different decision. Or even if they do, it's kind of offset by other things. So two very important things then in the decision making. Yes, the facticity, the circumstances of the situation, but also the values, the moral priorities, the way that we view things, very important. Which brings me on to the sex selection thing quite nicely, because my view is, I would describe myself in some ways as a pro-choice fundamentalist, right? You know, I seriously believe that it is a woman's right to decide whether or not she continues with the pregnancy, whatever her reason. Now, I actually think that the whole sex selection thing in Britain, it's different in some of the countries in the world, but in Britain, it is a really constructed panic, you know, a really constructed demonization with some very racial elements to it about women who are requesting abortion. We do 70,000 abortions a year. You know, the number of women who come into the clinic and they raise issues relating to gender, vanishingly small. I would say, typically, you know they're a journalist. But actually, to my mind, you know, is that a right reason or a wrong reason? If someone feels absolutely that they don't want to have a baby because they can't cope with a baby boy or a baby girl, I think she should be able to make that decision for herself. The law doesn't allow it like that at the moment. It says that for her to have the abortion legally, it has to be damaging to her physical or mental health. But my God, if someone is so determined that they want to have an abortion because they're carrying a child of the wrong gender, what do you really think it's a good idea to compel her to have that child that she doesn't want? Really, no way.
Kinga?
Yeah, and to pick up on what Anne been saying, we also have research from India where indeed sex-selective abortion, as it's called, has been prohibited. That hasn't done anything to diminishing the numbers of women that decide to do so. That is because it's not a matter of abortion, really. That's a matter of gender inequality and all kinds of other things and the position of women and how they regard it, etc. So it's a much more complex issue. And as the rest of the panelists, I am also a very strong proponent of choice and talking about choice because I think it's what makes us fundamentally human and something that's philosophically for me very important. And I know that there has been a lot of talking about circumstances, especially within the paradigm of something that's called reproductive justice, which basically sees abortion as a non, let's say, single-handed issue, which makes linkages to, you know, ethnicity, which makes linkages to your possibility to get resources. And it, of course, it's all true. And as an anthropologist, I don't have particular problem with having sort of competing narrations and competing discourses because that's what we deal with normally. But so it is so, and we can see it also in an example, for example, of Ireland and any other country that at the end, women that have resources have options, right? The ones that don't have access to resources have babies. As we often say. So that is on the idea of choice. And then another thing that I would like to sort of challenge is this idea that we have to do everything in our power to sort of prevent abortion from happening. So this kind of an aspect of responsibility, quote unquote, right? That it's more responsible to use contraception than not to use it. And this kind of characterization that yes, abortion is okay, but as a last resort, you know, when everything has failed, I think that's a very, very problematic discourse. Extremely stigmatizing, and I would say nowadays, as I see, this is in fact the main battle against, from where I stand, is exactly against this discourse that abortion is a sort of a public health necessity, right? But generally we should and ought to do everything in our power to diminish it and to make it rare. That's also something that we hear very often from the politicians. Well, guess what? I don't believe that. I actually think abortion is sort of a social good, and a state that respects women's choice and respects women's autonomy is empowering. I don't see abortion as an access to abortion as a bad thing.
Yes, can I just add something about choice there? And it's sort of, you might say, notes or observations from the campaign trail. I mean, in Ireland, obviously, we're campaigning very hard, and we have been doing for quite a long time. And what we're finding through research, but also on the doorsteps and at the stalls and when we're, you know, talking and working with people, is that the word choice is one that they shy away from, choice or choices. And I think because of the history, and in Ireland we have this really long and very difficult history around abortion for the past 34 years with all of these referendums which have been really divisive, very bitter, which have been very destructive in so many ways, not least in actually blocking women's choices, which is fundamental. But what we find is that choice, I often think they see people like me, you know, people like me have horns growing out of our head, and we are radical, disruptive revolutionaries who are going to open what Irish people call the floodgates, and somehow out of the floodgates will rush all kinds of demons. They said this when we had our same-sex marriage campaign that I was very involved in and that we won. And I don't quite know what is actually behind these mythical floodgates, but they do exist. It is all the fears. It's Pandora's box. And when it comes to abortion, choice is the word that takes the lid off that box. But of course, those of us who are campaigning so hard for this, we are we believe in choice. We believe in choice for abortion and for so many other things in our lives. It's a fundamental human right. So what we're trying to do at the moment, because we are on the campaign trail, and if we go up there with a placard that says, I am pro-choice, they're not going to listen. They're not going to talk with us. We've lost that opportunity to bring that voter somewhere. So we've decided to try as far as we possibly can to reinvest, to get to the meaning of choice. So we work through words like decision, making decisions, being responsible. Even autonomy is surprisingly okay to use. So we work through that way and then introduce the word choice or choices gradually. And it's really interesting to hear it working. We're now hearing medical professionals talking about their job being to support women in making choices. So I think it's really important to look at who are you talking with or to at a particular moment in time. We're not there to teach them a lesson. We're there to help them to understand what it is that women need in their lives, and what women need is to be able to have abortions when they want them, and that's it.
Can I have a mic down here? And there's a group of, so there's some at the front. So there's two at the front, and then okay, well you go first, and then two at the front, and then there's a cluster of hands at the back. If there's another, there's four guys. Name Mo. Yes, go.
I was slightly tying myself up in knots until the last couple of contributions, but I think there's something in here about remembering that certainly in the UK, we have never had the right to have an abortion. And because it's available and because it isn't a kind of everyday subject of conversation, perhaps that isn't widely known, perhaps it isn't really thought about, but there's something very interesting about the game changer, the abortion pill, coming becoming more available means that you almost kind of bypass the conversation about rights, and you just go straight to availability. I don't even have to ask anybody. I just have to have PayPal, and I can sort this out for myself. And I just wonder whether that enhances our rights as women, diminishes the conversation about our rights as women, and does it have any impact on our understanding of the kind of historical significance of abortion as part of the transformation of women to, if you like, from possessions to equal autonomous individuals?
Okay, that's an excellent. So basically, does technology mean we can sidestep the issues that we actually need to debate? The two at the front. Yes, yeah, so you two and then Mike, yeah.
I just wanted to ask whether you thought it was fair for people that are deeply pro-life to be funding through their taxpayer money kind of pro-choice sort of abortions. There's one thing to say that we want women to have access to abortions and for abortion to be legal, and then there's another thing to say that we want people to violate their own conscience and their own deeply held, sometimes religiously informed beliefs in favour of my own ideology that abortion is okay. I think there's a bit of hypocrisy there to a certain extent, because at the same time you say, I want the state out of my uterus, I want to make my own choice, I don't want anything to do with the government, controlling, sort of, kind of restricting my reproductive rights, but at the same time you want the state to fund your abortions. So I just wanted to see if you thought there was a bit of hypocrisy there at all.
It's an excellent question, and just to extend that, just to ask your opinion, would you extend that to, say, IVF services, where the destruction of embryos is...
Yeah, I generally think so. I think for issues which are more contentious morally, so, for example, I don't know anyone that's really against education, for example. I don't know that... There's some people that are against providing education by the state because they think it's... poorly run, but no one is really morally against education or morally against healthcare. But I think for issues that are more morally kind of divisive, you shouldn't be asking people to violate their conscience to fund your beliefs.
Okay, yep, and here.
Thank you. So my first question is about why do you think birth control for men is not being more talked about, only like birth control for women and educating women on this? Also, so Latin America is, I believe my country is one of the few that abortion is illegal in any way. I mean, we allow 12-year-old girl to die from in labor. We teenagers are dying by drinking chloride because they don't know how to do appropriate abortions. They learn there is literally no access to it. And I believe the question is, like, in what moment? I just really want to understand as a woman who came into this world and saw all these rules and standards, like, in what moment of life did the property of our ovaries was handed to a room full of men deciding on it, right? Because on top of that, then we tried to protest, like, we made a lot of protests in the Dominican Republic trying to pass this abortion law, at least on the three causalities. And, like, our representation in Congress is not even fair. Like, there is, like, less than 15% of women in Congress. Maybe does this have an influence, or, like, how do we also help these teenagers that in these countries that religion is so important and this conservative policies are?
That's a really interesting question. I think also raises the wider question of the relation between ideas about this area of life and gender. I mean, one of the things that's interesting in this country, if you look at a lot of the people that introduce bills to try and restrict abortion, they're women. So, yeah, there's that. So can this microphone go to the woman there that had the hand up? But to start off with, there's the mic and then the other guys around there, yeah.
Became a medical student 2 years after the 67 Act was introduced. So I've lived my whole professional life as a doctor under the shadow of the 1967 Act. I'm not old enough to remember the iniquities of backstreet abortions, but they were certainly living memory in my early days as a medical student and a doctor. And so I think I would definitely agree that we all have occasion to celebrate the tremendous historical advance that the 1967 Act represented, and I'm sure the campaigners from Ireland feel that particularly strongly. One of the things that I've always found as a doctor, you know, filling in up, referring people for terminations of pregnancy, is the green, what used to be the green form, it changed colour then at one stage, but it was always known as the green form, because the significance of the green form under the 1967 Act was that, as people have mentioned, that people didn't have, women didn't have access to abortion on demand, but only on the say-so of two doctors. And abortion, I mean, it was an advance on what existed before, but access to abortion restricted by the medical profession wasn't without its considerable difficulties. Doctors that I worked with always regarded it as effectively as abortion on demand, but we had to explain to people, look, we have to fill in this form. It's not like any other medical procedure that you might be referred to hospital for, but it has to be filled in a whole legal form. You have to sign it, the doctor has to sign it, you have to get another doctor to sign it. Now, that's inherently paternalistic and authoritarian, but it also, you know, raises the point that many women would come across GPs who wouldn't be prepared to sign their form in the whole areas of the country. People had great difficulty finding a doctor, so this would result in delays in access to termination or a refusal of access to termination. The medical profession also, I mean, one of the people talked about the abortion pill, the medical abortion. You know, one of the interesting questions, this is not a new technology. You know, yeah. The basic technology of a medical abortion is very old, yeah. At least 30 years old. And why is it now, only now? It's really actually the internet that put that on the agenda. And no doubt it has undermined the authority of the scope of the medical profession to control this. And there's a certain catching up that has to be done about this. But, you know, I think the other thing is that there has been in more recent years a very significant change in the climate around this thing. And actually, I think one of the things I would like to particularly pay tribute to in this discussion of the 50th anniversary is the specific role of the British Pregnancy Advisory Service in instigating this change. Because I think it has been tremendous. It's not, there are other abortion providers in this country, but the BPAS has taken the lead in changing the whole moral and political climate around the abortion discussion by making this issue of the autonomy of the woman the central issue in it and putting that centrally on the agenda. And I think that's been tremendous. And people don't, I think, quite appreciate or outside the medical profession. When you see the Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists endorsing this position, this is a historic shift. You know, this is one of the highly conservative royal colleges, one of the prestigious institutions of the medical profession that has fundamentally changed its position to one which it would never have endorsed even 5 years ago. And I think that's been the cumulative effect of campaigning consistently around this issue and not making any compromise on these issues of women's autonomy. Actually, and not only on the abortion issue, it might be said, the morning after pill, you know, is another thing. Why the iniquitous price that women have been charged for the morning after pill, a completely unjustifiable, arbitrary imposition, just for, you know, to assert a paternalistic control over women's access to contraceptive services. And absolutely iniquitous, which the BPS has campaigned very successfully against. You know, another very important thing. But I think that that's this is the why we've reached this historic moment, actually, that we can begin to consider treating abortion not under the green form like a criminal thing, but just like any other medical procedure. And I think this is the great example which we hope we'll see vindicated in Ireland whenever this referendum comes up.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you for BPAS.
Go that way, and then we'll come back over that way. Yep.
Actually, it follows on very nicely from that. I mean, I've been involved in abortion politics for quite a while, and for the longest time, it really seemed like we weren't making much progress. And if there was going to be any legislative change, it would be in a negative direction. And it is quite recent where that's changed. There is now the real possibility of legislatively liberalising abortion access in Britain and Ireland, and it is quite a sea change. My concern is that, as Mike was just explaining, it comes more from the medical profession and more from parliamentarians and politicos rather than some sort of grassroots movement. And I wonder if people on the panel share the concern that this is not something that's a bottom-up process. And then related to that, I get the impression that whatever is happening in Britain and Ireland is not happening in Central and Eastern Europe and is not happening in the United States either. I mean, I think in America there is a large chunk of the population who are out of kilter with the liberalization of abortion as it stands today. They don't like it. They would prefer for it to be more restricted. And I wonder, John, what problems that poses for you advocating for a liberalization of the legality of abortion against, you know, the stated positions of a large number of your countrymen. Is it possible to have liberalization of those circumstances? Is it right to have liberalization under those circumstances?
Okay, and then over there.
Can you hear me?
That's fine, and then give it backwards, yeah. That's fine, go.
Sex selection. I wonder if it gives rise to two different issues. The first issue being whether it should be banned, criminalised, or otherwise impeded. And I'm entirely at one with everything that's been said on the panel about that, which is that no, it shouldn't. But I don't think it follows from that that we can't, as individuals, express a moral view about whether or not it's right or wrong. And I wonder if there's a tendency, because of the individual rights discourse, or possibly the choice discourse, that we forget that without wishing to ban or impede something, there is still a moral sphere where the I want, therefore I must have, doesn't rule supreme. Because the issue of sexual selection, it seems to me, does raise social issues which are properly of concern to all of us, principally about the role of girls in society, but I know sex selections can happen both ways. There's a much wider issue there, I think, about whether it's right or wrong. I'd be interested to know what the panel think about that. The second question I have is that I get the impression that abortion in America has always been far more contested than it has been in Britain, and I'm sure there's a number of different reasons for that, but I wonder if one of them is because in this country we dealt with the issue in 1967 through the legislature, whereas in America, they dealt with it through the Supreme Court. And I suspect that a lot of people think that whenever the law is changed high-handedly from above by people who are not elected or representative or accountable to the people, people think those decisions are illegitimate, and they are right to think that. The reason why I raise that is because, of course, the issue of Northern Ireland abortions was in our Supreme Court last week. It would not surprise me at all with Brenda Hale as the president of the Supreme Court, and just generally because of the way these cases go these days, as if the Northern Ireland abortion ban is ruled to be incompatible with the claimant's human rights. That would, of course, be interesting, because whilst we might cheer the result, I think we ought to be very concerned about the way that such a conclusion had been reached. And I wonder what the panel thinks of that, if it happens.
One thing just to say on the sex selection thing, there's separate to abortion, the discussion that's gone on around that issue has been around assisted conception technologies, specifically pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. And people may know, as part of the 2008 revisions to the laws that regulate that aspect of reproductive technology, it's a law called the Human Fertilization Embryology Act. There was a specific revision to the law introduced in 2008 to prohibit the use of PGD for sex selection unless it's for medical reasons to do with sex-linked genetic conditions, serious illnesses that children get, which you can detect through screening the embryo and looking at its sex. And that's then you can predict the whether the child, were it to be born, would have the condition. What was interesting in the run-up to that was that there was quite a lot of evidence presented as part of it based on surveys, both in Europe and in this country, about people's preferences. So if people were given a preference, would they want to exercise it, and what would they do? And what it turned up is that, probably completely unsurprisingly, most people don't have a preference and wouldn't want to exercise it. But insofar as there was a preference, it was slightly more favourable towards females than males. So in other words, if people were going to choose, they would be slightly more likely to choose to have girls than boys. Anyway, there you go, insofar as there's research about this thing. Yep.
I'd like to ask a little bit about this question of bringing evidence into the whole argument. I'm concerned about what the debate in Ireland will be like. So I grew up in Ireland, so I've seen kind of the abortion debates over many years. Very emotive, and there's very little actual evidence presented, often on either side, so I'm not including people here today. And looking at what happened last year with the same-sex marriage debate, yes, I was personally glad about the outcome, but the debate was horrendous, I felt, because at what the discussion was all about, if you thought it was okay to have same-sex marriage, you were a good person, and if you didn't, you were a bad person, you were out of date, you were old-fashioned. And that's not fair. It's about discussing what the arguments are. People can disagree. We should be able to have a grown-up discussion about things based on evidence, then make decisions, and still respect people who respectfully disagree with us. Because I know, like my parents, for example, who voted against same-sex marriage, but they would never go out and campaign and stop people getting married. They felt they were asked the question, should it be allowed? And they didn't think it should be allowed. And